It rose up within her in full being. Jess's rejection. It had been in Jess's townhome in the Valorian capital. Fawn-colored curtains. Kestrel couldn't remember all the exact words, but she knew now why the friendship had broken. She heard herself quietly saying the very things that Jess would never forgive, saw her former self choosing against her own people, her friends, her father. "He has done this to you," Jess had accused. "No one has made me change." "But you have!" Kestrel turned onto her other side. Arryn had been in the Queen's City then. She knew that now. She sat up, flung the sheet aside. It was not natural. It wasn't possible that she'd given up so much. And for what? She was ready to believe in enchantments. How else could it be that her body still felt the pull of Arryn, seemed to remember him all too clearly when her mind didn't, and sent her to his empty bed, sealed her between his sheets, made her care where he went, and what he risked, and what he did, and with whom? She reached for her set of keys. 17. She went swiftly through the dark house, her feet bare and noiseless on the tiles, the carpet, the steps. Up one flight, hand skimming the balustrade. At the landing, her palm spun around the newel. She went left. She knew Arryn's home well. Knew it now, knew it then. She felt time layer. The present slipped over the past. She'd never taken this path before, but she'd thought about it. She flipped through the keys, found the right one, set it into the outermost door of Arryn's suite, and opened it. She stepped into white light. It startled her, seemed hallucinatory, impossible, as if she dropped into a silver pond. But then she glanced up and saw a skylight above the entryway. The moon hung low and large. Though the oil lamp sconces were unlit, the hallway was almost as bright as day. At the other end of it, darkness. A brief clinking sound came from the recesses of the suite. She drew closer to the shadowed end of the hallway, passed through a dark receiving room. She barked her thigh against a console table and swore under her breath. Another hallway, a turn, then a soft glow, a lamp, a liquid sound, a muffled thump. Glass on wood? She stepped into the lamp-lit room. Arryn looked up from where he sat. His fingers tightened around the glass in his hand. He stared. She flushed, realizing that she'd forgotten to throw a robe over her thin nightdress. Or had she forgotten? Had she not decided, in some way too quick for thought, that this was exactly what she'd wanted? She glanced down at the shift's hem, which hit just below the knees. The cloth was as sheer as melted butter. Her flush deepened. She saw the expression on Arryn's face. He glanced away. "Gods," he said, and drank. "Exactly." That brought his gaze back. He swallowed, winced, and said, "It's possible that I've lost any claim to coherent thought, but I've no idea what you mean." "Those gods of yours." His dark brows were lifted. His eyes had grown round. The glass in his hand was a tumbler, the liquid a thumb's width high and deep green. It looked like the blood of leaves. He cleared his throat. Hoarsely, he said, "Yes." "Did you pray to them?"
"Kestrel, I'm praying to them right now. Very hard, in fact."
She shook her head. "Did you pray to your..." She rummaged through her memory. "God of souls." She was ready to believe in a supernatural reason. It would explain his power over her. He coughed and gave a short, rasping laugh.
"That god doesn't listen to me."
He set the tumbler next to the carafe on the table. He paused, thinking. In a new, slow tone, he said,
"Except perhaps now."
He dropped his cheek into an open palm and rubbed fingers into one closed eye. He nodded at the chair across the table from him.
"Would you like to sit?"
Now that she was here, she wasn't sure she actually wanted to get closer to him. Her pulse had gone erratic.
"I'm fine here." "I'd really rather."
"If I make you uncomfortable, why don't you leave?" He laughed again.
No. No, thank you. Here."
He slid the glass across the table. The remaining liquid sloshed, but didn't spill. When she sat, curious, what would the blood of leaves taste like? He said,
You might want to try only a bit first.
That's not wine.
It decidedly is not.
What is it?
An eastern liquor. Rishar gave it to me. He said that if you drink enough of it, the dregs start to taste like sugar. I suspect a prank.
But you've no head for drink. He looked as startled as she felt.
Of all the things, you remember that.
She had remembered something else, too, as she'd tried to sleep. She'd come to ask him about it, but the words stuck in her throat. Instead, she appraised him. You seem clear-minded enough.
It's early. Still, I don't know. This conversation feels just shy of a delusion.
She fiddled with the glass. I want to understand a few things.
Ask me.
She wasn't yet ready to share what she remembered. She set the glass down. What did you tell the queen?
I told Anisha about you.
What, exactly? He hesitated.
I'm afraid to say.
I want you to.
You might leave.
I won't. He stayed silent. She said, I give you my word.
I told her that I belong to you and no other. I said that I was sorry.
She couldn't help the rush of pleasure and jealousy. His words did make her want to leave. She felt so unalterably his. It was bewildering because she didn't know him, not really, and he knew two halves of her that she couldn't fit together. He was waiting for her to speak. He was so still. She realized he was holding his breath. She said, That's political suicide. He smiled a little. How did she respond?
She said, You overestimate your importance.
Is that why you're drinking?
Kestrel, you know why I am drinking.
She looked into the shadowed corners of the room. Talking with him was like having a flower unfold inside her chest, then close up tight, creep open, collapse in on itself. Voice low, she said, Why do you call her Anisha? That's not her name.
It's her little name.
The pause made Kestrel think that he'd been translating a Dakran term in his mind before speaking it, but also that he'd been translating her question and recognizing the implied intimacy it exposed between him and the queen. He held Kestrel's eyes.
There never would have been anything between her and me if I'd known the truth about you. I should have known it. I can't forgive myself for not knowing it. As it was yesterday in the garden, you asked if I used her for political gain. I didn't. I used her to forget about you. You probably don't want to know that. It's ugly. But I must tell you because there's been too much hiding. More would break me.
She looked at the green liquor left in the glass. It was green. It was liquid. This was a glass. To hide from her would break him. Simple things, so apparent, so not anything other than what they showed themselves to be. She dipped a finger into the liquor's dregs and touched it to her tongue. It burned. Aaron made a sound. She glanced up. She didn't know where her voice had gone. She was nervous. Her flesh was resonant with the knowledge of what she wanted to understand and what she'd come here to find out. It was much riskier than what she'd already asked. She stood. He watched her pace toward him. She stopped just short of his chair and looked down at him. Her loose hair slipped over her shoulder. I remember something. I'm not sure if it happened or not. Will you tell me?
Yes, he whispered.
I remember lying with you on the lawn of the Imperial Palace's spring garden. He shifted. Lamplight pulsed over his face. He shook his head. I remember finding you in your suite. This memory was coming to her now. It had a similar flavor as the last one. I promised to tell you my secrets. You held a book. Or a kindling. You were making a fire.
That didn't happen.
I kissed you. She touched the hollow at the base of his neck. His pulse was wild.
Not then, he said finally.
But I have before. There was a rush of images. It was as if the melody she'd imagined while lying in the dark had been dunked in the green liquor. All the cold stops gained heat and ran together. It was easy to remember Aaron, especially now. Her hand slid to his chest. The cotton of his shirt was hot. "Your kitchens. The table, honey, and flour." His heart slammed against her palm.
"Yes."
"A carriage."
"Yes."
"A balcony."
Breath escaped him like a laugh.
"Almost."
"I remember falling asleep in your bed when you weren't here." He pulled back slightly, searched her face.
"That didn't happen."
"Yes, it did." His mouth parted, but he didn't speak. The blacks of his eyes were bright. She wondered what it would be like to give her body what it wanted. It knew something she didn't. Her heart sped. Her blood was lush in her veins.
"The first day," she said. "Last summer. Your hair was a mess. I wanted to sweep it back and make you meet my eyes. I wanted to see you."
His chest rose and fell beneath her hand.
"I don't know. I don't know what you wanted."
"I never said."
"No."
She lowered her mouth to his. She tasted him, the raw burn of liquor on his tongue. She felt him swallow, heard the low, dry sound of it. He pulled her down to him, tangled his hands in her hair, sucked the breath from her lips. She became uncertain whose breath was whose. He kissed her back, fingertips fanning across her face, then gone, nowhere. Then, a light touch along the curve of her hip, just barely, a stone skipping the surface of the water.
"Strange,"
he murmured into her mouth. She wasn't listening. She was rippling, the sensation spreading wide. Stone on water, dimpled pockets of pressure, the wait for the stone to finally drop down. Suddenly she knew, or thought she knew, what he found strange as he traced where a dagger should have been, to see a part of her missing. She felt her missing pieces, the stark gaps. She was arrested by the thought. It pierced her, sharp and surreal, that she'd become transparent, that if he touched her again, his hand would go right through her, into air, into the empty spaces of who she was now. She didn't want to be empty, didn't want to vanish. She wanted to be whole. She said,
"I want to remember you."
An emotion flared in his face. He braced her hips, tugged her closer. His lids were heavy, eyes dark. His mouth was a wet gleam. She didn't recognize his expression. It was new. She leaned in and drank the newness of him. Their kiss turned savage. She made it so. She felt his teeth, reveled in the sure knowledge that it had never been like this between them. Yet, at the same time, she felt each kiss they'd shared before, felt them live inside this one. His mouth left hers, rasping down her neck. He buried his face in her skin. She sought his mouth and found that he tasted different now. She was tasting the taste of her skin on his mouth. Coppery. She dipped her tongue into it again.
"Kestrel."
She didn't answer him.
"This is a bad idea."
"No," she said. "It isn't."
He pulled away, closed his eyes, and dropped his head to press his brow against her belly. She felt rich with the words he muttered against her nightdress. His mouth burned through the cloth. His chair scraped back. He no longer touched her.
"Not like this."
"Yes, exactly like this."
She tried to find the words to express how this helped, how he somehow mapped the country of herself, showed the ridges, the rise and valley of her very being.
"Kestrel, I think that you were using me a little."
She stopped, unpleasantly startled. It occurred to her that what he'd said was another version of what she'd been struggling to say.
"It's not, a hardship."
He gave a rueful smile.
"It's not that I don't want..."
She'd never heard him stammer. Even with her untrustworthy memory, she knew this. "You're easy to know," she wanted to say. Memories of him came quickly. It didn't hurt, not as much as she'd feared before, on the tundra or in his empty bed. At least it didn't hurt anymore. It was better. Better than... other things. A faceless horror. A monster. Inside her. It thickened, grew into a featureless, blunt shape. She wouldn't touch it. She'd go nowhere near it. Aaron had been right that day when he'd suggested that there was something too horrible for her to remember.
"It's not enough," he said.
It took her a moment to realize he was continuing his refusal and not responding to her thoughts, which were so loud in her head that she felt as if she'd shouted them. She said,
"What would be enough?"
Color mounted in his face.
"You can tell me," she said.
"Oh," he said. "Well, me."
"I don't understand."
"I want you to want me."
"I do."
He pushed a hand through his rough hair.
"I don't mean this."
He gestured between them, his hand flipping from her to him.
"I..."
He struggled, knuckled his eyes, and let the words come.
"I want you to be mine, wholly mine, your heart, too. I want you to feel the same way."
Her stomach sank. She'd sworn to herself not to lie to him. He read her answer in her eyes. He dimmed and said nothing either, but he brushed hair from her face, lifting away strands that had caught in her eyelashes and between her lips. His fingertip painted a slow line over her lower lip. She felt it down her spine, in her belly. Then his hand fell away, and she felt alone.
"I leave tomorrow morning with Rashar," he said. "It'll be some time before I return."
An ember of hurt. An old feeling, as old as her whole life. She was always being left. War always won. She saw herself, a little girl, holding up a level sheathed sword nearly as long as she was tall. Her arms ached. She must not drop it. The man on the horse would take it soon. He glanced down, and she wondered if he was waiting to see how long she could hold the blade steady. He smiled, and her twinned heart, the girl, the woman, her past, her present, burst with pride and sorrow and rage.
"Take me with you," she told Aaron.
A shadow crossed his face.
"No, absolutely not."
"I can help. I know my father's system of running scouts, his tactics, codes, formations."
"No."
"You don't have the right to choose for me."
"It won't happen."
He caught his anger, became aware of it as well as hers, and said more gently,
"It's too dangerous."
"I can take care of myself."
"I can't lose you."
Grief slashed through his voice.
"Not you, too."
The story he had told her about the night of the invasion flickered in his eyes, darkening them. Her father had done this to him. She remembered her father, felt the memory squeeze her, a crunch, a creak of bone, and then seemed to feel how Aaron guessed where her mind had gone. She felt what the direction of her thoughts did to him. She had begged her father to let her go to war with him. He'd promised that one day she would, but then she had grown and no longer wanted what he wanted, and wanted him to stay instead, and he wouldn't. Aaron's story and hers twisted together into patterns she couldn't follow. Their silence grew. Quietly, Aaron said,
"I'll stay."
Her eyes flew to him. It was so unexpected that she was shaken out of her thoughts.
"If you want,"
he said,
"I could stay. We'd be together."
"If you stay here while the Dacrans march south to fight your war, the Alliance will crumble."
He studied his hands.
"Unless you do it for the Queen."
He gave Kestrel a reproachful look.
"Then you can't," she said.
"Do you want me to stay?"
Kestrel wondered if every question is a way of putting yourself at the mercy of someone else.
"It would cost you too much."
"Think about it. Will you think about it? We're to leave at dawn. Meet me then at the brook, the one near the horse paths, to tell me what you've decided."
Her answer should be no, yet she couldn't make herself say it.
"Meet me anyway," he said, "even if it's to say goodbye. Will you wish me well?"
Kestrel saw the ripped grass of the battlefield, stained with gore. Him, broken, bloody, skin ashen. His blank gaze fixed on something she couldn't see. His light gone.
"Stay,"
she almost said.
Then an invisible hand clamped down over her mouth and warned again about the political consequences. Either way, Kestrel read his doom. Death in battle, or the slower death of the Alliance collapsing and the Empire's victory. Tears welled in her eyes. She turned so that he wouldn't see them.
"Won't you wish me well?" Auron asked.
"I will. I do." He seemed uncertain.
"If I don't see you at dawn, I'll take it to mean that you want me to go."
"I'll be there," she told him. "I promise." 18. She couldn't sleep. She roamed the dreaming house, saw copper pots gleaming in the dark kitchen like a row of hung moons. Her feet made mouse sounds on the staircases. She found the library, remembered touching the spines of the books when she'd lived here before. She touched them again. She remembered and touched them, touched and remembered. Her piano was a large shadow in the parlor. Arryn had brought it from her home. This was before the prison, before the Imperial Palace. He'd asked her to stay and share his life. She'd left him, had gone down to the harbor and stolen a fishing boat. The stormy sea, the Emperor, a choice. The capital, stiff lace, sugar, snow, thick blood, skinned fingers, a white knuckle joint.
"Choose," the Emperor had said when she'd stood before him for the first time and saw his cold cunning.
She'd chosen to marry his son. Her father had been proud. Memory crept over her skin in a prickling rash. Through a silvered window, Kestrel saw the harbor. The bay was a bucket of light. Although she wasn't cold, she chafed her bare shoulders in the habit of someone who'd once been cold for a long time. Her hands paused in their movements when she realized what she was doing. Again, she wondered at it, the way the mind and the body have different sets of memories that aren't necessarily always aware of each other. She was not cold, yet she felt cold. There was a lump of ice in her heart. She didn't know what she would say to Arryn when dawn came. The choice he'd offered became so large that she couldn't clearly see either stay or go, only choice. She was afraid of choices. She'd paid dearly for them. She looked at the harbor and remembered standing there last winter, her breath of fog, Arryn's too, her hand on a jagged shard of pottery sharp as a knife, the fishing boat rocking at its dock. He'd let her escape, had chosen her freedom and his probable ruin, simply because he couldn't bear the thought of forcing her to stay. Arryn wasn't the ice in her heart. He didn't cause the fear that kept her from knowing who she was and what she'd done and what had been done to her. Who was Kestrel? She turned over what she knew, studied the pieces of her old self. Honorable, Arryn had said. Brave, she'd thought before. She imagined this Kestrel, a creature strayed out of stories, and wished that she could be like her. Her feet were moving. They were heading to Sarcine's rooms. They stole over the floorboards as she opened doors, opened a wardrobe, fastened clothes. She pulled on boots. The soldiers would ride south at dawn. She had several hours. The moonlight was strong, bright enough. She left the house by a back door for servants. She quickened her pace over flagstones, through the garden, and across the grounds to the stables. The high, dark grass rippled around the villa in the warm wind. She let Javelin walk toward the house. Somewhere on the grounds must be a pond or creek she couldn't see. Frogs sang. The full moon shone overhead, its light diminishing the stars. The house was grand in its silence, its windows shut tight. A shudder shook her, and she understood the nature of her fear a little better than she had before. It wasn't formless. It was sharply specific. It was the fear of pain. She swung a leg off Javelin and dropped down into the grass. It itched. She pushed through it, let it tickle, annoy. "Look at the grass," she thought. "It is grass. The house is a house. The moon a moon. They are themselves and nothing else." Her feet found a flagstone path hidden beneath the grass. She pushed forward, holding a dead lantern she'd taken from the saddlebag. She longed to light it, yet dreaded what it might show. The house, the second-floor windows, those eaves, that portico, all so clearly and sickeningly hers, held a secret she must understand. She felt naked when she came out of the grass. She looked back over her shoulder, saw the dark arch of Javelin's neck. Then she met the blank black eyes of the villa's windows.
"Nothing's there," Arryn had said. "It's empty."
No, it wasn't. Something was in there. She felt it swell against the walls.
"I'd be with you,"
Arryn had said that day on the horse paths. She knew that she could turn around this very moment, return, wake him. He wouldn't question her. He wouldn't say, "Wait." "Some horror," she'd tell him, and then stop, unable to say more.
"I'll come with you," he'd answer. "You won't be alone."
A door whined open at her unsteady touch. The smell was an assault. She gagged on the familiarity of it. Redolent, orange-scented wood oil, windows washed with vinegar. A clean house, her clean house, the cleanliness of every day of almost all her life. The childhood smell she didn't realize was from her childhood until she had forgotten it and encountered it again. It stripped away whatever strength she'd had. She almost stumbled from the entryway and back out into the night. Then a thought brushed her panicked consciousness. It was gentle and gave her pause. It said that the smell's familiarity wasn't just the fermented memory of many years. She'd also encountered this smell, orange, vinegar, lye, recently. In some small way, one difficult to determine. She lit the lamp. The house burst into being. It was empty. Jagged shadows, glittering tiles. She passed into a parlor, feeling pushed. The echoes she made here were quieter. This room had a wooden floor, paler in places where furniture had been. Its varnish gleamed. The house, though abandoned for months, grounds unkept, grass hip-high, was clean. No dust. She went from room to room. She stopped in one that had windowed double doors facing the garden. Sheet music-lined inset shelves built specially with narrow dividers to hold the thin booklets which were neatly organized. Though not, she realized as she went through them, the music echoing inside her as she traced a marked passage, not exactly as she had organized them. The Harani music was arranged by composer. She saw her old self, that elegant ghost slipping the music into its slots. The Valorian music, little though there was of it, was organized in the same way. But that wasn't right. She wouldn't have classed the Valorian music like that. Valorians ordered books by the binding's color, which was coded by subject. They organized music by kind. Kestrel went through the music again, recalling how she'd missed these pieces when she was in the capital, but didn't ask for them, because to ask was to admit that she missed something from her home, and it was too hard to think about what she missed, and too dangerous to reveal that she missed anything at all. Another person had painstakingly organized these booklets. Not her, not a Valorian. She heard the memory of Arryn's voice.
"I have no interest in the music room."
It hadn't been true then. It wasn't true now. She understood now what had stopped her from leaving the villa. It had been a feathery sort of almost idea, its fronds still floating in her mind. "You know where you've smelled that too clean smell before. Orange, vinegar, lye." Arryn. It had been when she was sore and broken and in between dreams, and he slept in a chair beside her bed in the suite that had belonged to his mother. He had woken.
"Go back to sleep," he'd murmured.
He'd had a strange scent, an alkaline tang. Clean, she'd thought then. Too clean. Soft, gold lamplight. His voice, its low timbre, the gleam of eyes. Slow silence. Then sleep. Kestrel lifted the lamp higher, though she didn't need its light like she had when she'd first entered the house. It was easier to see now. This room was just an empty space, where things had once been, and the dread of those things no longer overwhelmed her, because she no longer felt alone. She explored the house. Night lifted. Shadows dwindled into their corners. Kestrel didn't notice this, or if she did, she thought it was because her mind saw better, not her eyes. She waded through her memory. Her mother, her nurse and I, a love so full that it welled up beneath her breastbone. Her suite, painted walls. In the bedchamber where a curtain had hung, the scratched lines of a name, Jess. They'd done it with a pen when they were little. There was no curve to the scratched letters. Each S was all angles. Kestrel touched the name and knew she'd find her own on the wall of Jess's suite. She recalled the pen digging into paint. Her eyes stung. The lamp burned low. It gave off a hot ceramic odor. She knew vaguely that time was running out, but she was so lost in time that she knew it was running out without really knowing what this meant. She walked quickly now. There was a tug on her heart, like it had been tied with twine and someone had jerked a loose end. Again, the fear of pain, the surety that it would come, a drag forward. She dug in her heels and stopped. Gray light glowed in the windows. She remembered her promise to Aaron, the worry in his voice.
"Won't you wish me well?"
She thought of the person who had cleaned her home, for no other reason, as far as she could tell, than that this home was hers and he didn't want it to be dirty. She thought of how he'd feel to leave the city with his question unanswered, his offer disregarded, with not even a wish for his safe return. The awfulness of it hit her with a cold, fresh slap. She could make it to him by dawn if she left now. She strode down a hallway, fast, footsteps ringing loud. She reached a landing, ready to race down the stairs and back out into the grass. But the twine tied inside her cut harder, pulling tight. Before she knew it, she crossed the landing and entered a narrow, mirrored gallery, her shadow flitting alongside her. At the end of the gallery was a door. Behind the door was a suite. Dark wainscoting lined the walls, and she remembered silk curtains on the now bare rods.
"Your mother chose the color,"
her father had said, looking at the curtains as though he couldn't say what their color was. Kestrel was in her father's rooms. She groped her way back to the stairs, retreating. She'd lost her lamp. She stumbled past a small ballroom, a dining hall, the parlor. She gripped the knob of a door, the library. She remembered him better in the library than in his suite, to which she'd rarely been invited. He didn't brook intrusion. The library was achingly familiar, even with the books missing. There was no sign of violence here. Still, it felt as if violence had been done, as if the books had been gouged out of their inset shelves. There used to be a translucent red paperweight that had sat on a squat marble-topped table. The paperweight had been made from blown glass. She recalled the whorls beneath her fingertips. He'd used it to hold down maps. She didn't know where it was now. She sat on the floor where a chair had been. As a pearled dawn touched her wet eyes, searing the room orange and pink and yellow, Kestrel knew that she'd come to this house for only one true reason, to find her father. Her memory limped up to her. It crawled into her lap. Kestrel didn't remember everything, but she remembered enough. 19. Aaron arrived early at the brook in the gray hour before dawn, sat on the grass, had thoughts that kept forcing each other from his head. Nervous, he pressed his palms hard against the earth. He was too nervous. She didn't come. He watched the water glint with the rising sun. The brook gently coursed along its path. Birds sang out. An Uriel called, notes flat and sweet. It repeated itself. There was no answer. It continued, the sound casting a spell. The bird sounded caught in its own enchantment. He waited as long as he could. Eventually, a quiet part of him admitted that he had doubted all along. He never really expected she would come. It had been doubt, hadn't it, that had kept him from sleeping after she'd left his rooms. Not the difficult pleasure of her presence there, or how her absence felt. Not the anticipation of war, nor the possibility that she might lay claim to him. Be honest now. He held himself to honesty, held hard, conceded. Yes, the pleasure and difficulty and absence and anticipation had all conspired to keep him from sleep last night. Still, doubt, fizzy, sour,
had also been part of it. And now some heavy emotion, round, about the size of the hollow of his palm, an emotion he seemed to have kept in an invisible pocket and now took out to see fully. Just a small sorrow, he told himself. Small because expected. What else could he have expected? He plucked a few blades of grass, rubbed them between fingers and thumb, and inhaled the young scent. Then, he knew it was odd. He wanted the oddity of it to distract him, or to give him one last thing to do before he left, because maybe she would arrive in that final moment if he waited but one more moment. He put a blade of grass in his mouth and chewed. It tasted soapy, clean. She wasn't coming. She probably had never had any intention of coming. He went to ready his horse. Arryn drew up short several paces from the stables. Soldiers, perhaps 100 strong, on horse and on foot, gathered on the hill. The morning was loud with the huff and stamp of horses, the rough irritation of people who got in each other's way, the click and tap of metal and leather, the slap of a saddle dropped on a horse's back. None of this surprised Arryn. What surprised him was the sight of Rashar, standing with 2 saddled horses, smiling at him. Rashar approached, the horses walking behind.
"You're late. Sleep in, did you?"
Arryn said nothing.
"Here you are."
Rashar passed the reins.
"You ride this one sometimes, I've noticed. He's good. Not as good as mine, but he'll do. I thought you'd want to leave that big war horse behind. Hers, isn't it?" "Javelin stays."
"Of course,"
Rashar said easily.
"Well, wasn't this thoughtful?"
He swept his hand at Arryn's saddled horse.
"Yes, though a little unlike you." "Never say so. I am the soul of thoughtfulness."
Arryn found himself smiling faintly back. He mounted the horse. Everyone ordered themselves behind him and the prince. They would make their way down to the city, gathering soldiers as they went. Eventually, they'd reach the harbor, where eastern soldiers who'd come on ships waited for them. Then the march south. But first, they passed along the path to the house. A few people lined the path, having learned or guessed of the soldiers leaving. Kestrel wasn't there. Sarsine was, and the queen. Anisha lifted one sardonic brow at him and said,
"Careful."
But Sarsine, she looked different than he'd ever seen, like she knew he wasn't sure he'd come back this time. He thought that his promise to his god might be absolute. She was weeping. She held out flowers, tiny ones that grew at the base of trees, in their shadows, the kind you had to get on your hands and knees to see properly. They had been his favorites, long ago. He took them. From his height on the horse, he leaned to brush away her tears.
"Don't,"
he said, which only made her eyes swim again.
"I love you," she said.
He said that he loved her, too. The horse moved forward. His hand fell away. The distance grew between them.
"Don't you worry," murmured a voice within him. "I take care of my own."
Yet the god of death sounded ominous.
"I heard you," the god added. "Last night, a promise to stay, to miss it all. Arryn, you made me a promise. Glory, in my name. Or do I misremember?"
Arryn said nothing.
"Ah, Arryn, you're lucky that I like you."
"Why do you?"
Arryn asked. But the god just smirked silently inside him. The ships stayed in the bay. The queen would defend the city. Arryn tried to dismiss the thought that she could easily claim it for her own. He had no choice but to trust her. A few thousand marched south. They could only travel as fast as foot soldiers walked and supply wagons trundled. The roads were good. They were Valorian, made after the invasion by slave labor. They were paved for war.
"You haven't asked me about Arryn," Rashar said as he rode alongside him.
"What?"
"The tiger, not the surly human. I thought it was best to leave him behind to keep my sister company, since you won't."
Arryn shot him a look.
"Did I say I wanted you to be my sister's pet? Did I not merely imply it in order to get under that ridiculously thin skin of yours? I'd prefer to have you here."
"Why?"
It would have been a mistake to stay. Don't tell me you didn't consider it. She...
You mean Kestrel?
I mean both of them. I'll say nothing of your little ghost. You'd chuck me off my horse, and then I'd have to kill you for insubordination, which would set the tone nicely for the army's underlings, but would be messy and inconvenient.
Make your point.
Rashar turned serious.
Watch your beck, especially around my sister.
Arryn's gaze flicked over him. He didn't think Anisha would appreciate that warning.
Are you disloyal to her?
Roshar's smile said that he found it charming that Arryn would ask such a direct question and expect a direct answer.
Never.
The sound of the army, the creak of wagons, the hooves, boots, bits of conversation in two different languages, hammered the thoughts from Arryn's head. But he still carried that emotion with him, the one he'd found by the brook. It knocked against his breastbone, a small, heavy stone. Yellow thorn bushes bloomed by the side of the road. Once he saw Fox and her kits tumble out of a bush and scramble across the road in front of him. He'd stayed his horse, feeling foolish, then relieved to see them dodge several sets of hooves and make it safely to the other side.
"The Valorian general might try again to land at Lerilyn's beach," Roshar said.
"It'd be costly."
"True, but it's still the best location for a large invasion. He's got the numbers to do it. If reports are right, our force is the smaller one. Still, we are better looking, which is a significant advantage."
"I think that it's not just about winning for him."
Arryn remembered Kestrel at the gaming table.
"He likes to win with style, make you feel the fool for ever thinking you could compete. He could push all his troops up onto that beach and bleed them out and still win, and come up north to take the city. Brute force victory. A nasty one, though, with heavy losses, and a little too straightforward. He prefers a trick. He already played one with the cliffs. Unless he's got another trick up his sleeve for the beach, I wouldn't focus our forces there."
"If we have none in position at Lerilyn, he'll walk right onto the peninsula with no resistance."
"Send a division."
"Two-thirds.
Plus most of the supplies and infantry. Stationed there. The rest of the army keeps moving south. Light, fast, mainly cavalry, small cannon, and guns."
"Where would you put your people?"
"Where you want them."
Roshar's eyes went exaggeratedly round.
"How very accommodating of you.
So long as they are under my command."
"Why not?"
Roshar said graciously.
"So long as you are under mine."
Night. Without commenting on it, Arryn and Roshar had pitched their tents near each other. A small fire crackled. A chill had crept into the air. The weather was changing. Roshar lay on his back, the dip of his neck bolstered by a tied bedroll. He smoked.
"I've been thinking. Dear gods, it occurs to me that you have no official rank, and that I, as your prince, might give you one."
He said an eastern word Arryn didn't know.
"Well, will it suit?"
"Depends."
"On?"
"Whether that word was some horrific insult you're pretending is an actual military rank."
"How mistrustful. Arryn, I have taught you every foul curse I know."
"I'm sure you've saved a few for just such a time."
Roshar said something about pigs and Arryn's fondness for certain questionable practices. Arryn laughed.
"I wasn't joking earlier," Roshar said. "I don't know how to translate that word. For your rank, it puts you third, after Zesh."
The sea captain had requested the queen's permission to leave his ships under her orders, and that of his second in command. He wanted to be part of the land operation.
"He has the experience. He fought the general in the mountains 4 years back. He's good. Also, he'd kill me if I ranked you above him."
Arryn shifted a log and watched the darting sparks.
"Thank you."
Roshar squinted up at him, dragging on his pipe, its bowl blistered red.
"You don't seem wholly pleased."
Smoke curled around his face.
"What is it? What makes you not glad for third? You don't like Zesh."
"Neither do I."
"So what? You can't have second, and you damned well won't get first."
He studied Arryn more carefully.
"No, it's not thwarted ambition that's bothering you, not even wounded pride, which is usually the obvious interpretation where you're concerned. Not this time, somehow. Aaron, you're not nervous, are you? You're perfect for this. You want it. Just earlier today you claimed command of the Harani. I must. I'm responsible for them. And they love you. They think you're some holy gift from your gods. Very nice work, I must say. I didn't mean for that to happen. Even better, makes it seem more authentic. Convenience, you understand, when sending people to their deaths.
Aaron looked at his stolen Valorian boots and felt the fire's heat in his cheeks.
Too late to have qualms about death and dying and killing, Rashar said. You're in it. Some people were born to be in it.
Aaron wondered if that's why Kestrel hadn't come, because she could smell death on him.
Rashar said, You'll do well. I know.
Rashar crossed a leg over one bent knee, sat up slightly to knock spent ash out of his pipe by rapping it against a boot, then eased back against his bedroll.
I smell rain. The leaves of the trees are cupped for it. You can't see that in this dark. I see it in my mind.
The smoke from his pipe lingered. He folded his arms across his chest. His body looked close to sleep.
Aaron.
Aaron, who was sitting with his forearms propped on bent knees, fingers loose, felt nowhere near asleep.
Yes? How do I look in the dark?
Startled, Aaron glanced at him. The question had had no edges. It wasn't sleek, either. Its soft, uncertain shape suggested that Rashar truly wanted to know. In the fired red shadows, his limbs looked lax, and his mutilated face met Aaron's squarely. The heavy feeling that Aaron carried, that specific sadness, nestled just below his collarbone like a pendant, lessened. He said,
Like my friend.
Rashar didn't smile. When he spoke, his voice matched his expression, which was rare for him. Rarer still, his tone. Quiet and true.
You do, too.
Alone in his tent, Aaron must have fallen asleep at some point. He woke, expecting Kestrel to be beside him. Her presence seemed clear and real as when she'd stood before him in his rooms. That thin shift, the sear of her hot skin.
I want to remember you. Go back to sleep, he told himself. You can't hold her to any promise.
He curled onto his side. There was a clap of thunder. The sky opened. Rain pattered the canvas and grew loud. It didn't let up. Water streamed down the horses as they walked. Afternoon looked no different from morning, which hadn't looked a lot different from night. Everything was a muddled gray. Aaron was soaked to the skin. Rain ran off his nose. Progress was slow. Aaron fell back to the middle lines and stopped to help shoulder a wagon wheel out of a slick rut between split paving stones. He'd just mounted his horse again when he realized that a halt must have been called. Everyone stayed where they were. He rode up through the ranks to Rashar.
What is it?
He asked the prince.
A parting of ways.
Rashar nodded at the road ahead, and he pulled a waxed map from a tube in his saddlebags. Aaron took a roughly woven blanket from his and sidled his horse along Rashar's, reaching the blanket over him and the prince as a shield to keep the worst of the rain off the map. The road would soon fork. West lay Laralyn.
I'm going to listen to your advice, Rashar said. We split. Most to the west, some south. Lay your bets, Aaron. It's your country. Where will the action be?
Aaron studied the map, worrying his lower lip between his teeth.
Said Death. Those estates look nice.
A few unwalled villages stood near them. The estates were far enough south that it'd be easy for the general to run his supplies from Ithria onto the mainland.
One of these,
Aaron said, rain dripping from his mouth. It felt like he was spitting.
If the general gains a foothold there, he can strengthen his position, take almost everything he needs from the estates except black powder. He could creep up, spread out, form flanks to the east and west, scoop us up, push to the city.
Rashar rolled and stowed the map. Aaron lowered the blanket, which was soaked. He'd have a wet night. Rashar looked up into the rain, blinking.
Almost feels like home.
He squinted at Arryn.
Do you want to go with Zesh to Lerilyn?
Arryn shook his head.
That's what I thought.
The army divided. Arryn rode south with Roshar. Near dusk, the rain stopped, but it had been falling so long that Arryn seemed to still see it dribbling across his vision. The diminished army set up camp for the night, swearing at the mud, the mood miserable. Arryn's tent had stayed mostly dry in its tarp. A change of clothes, too, buried at the bottom of a saddlebag. Everything else was damp. He unbuckled his leather armor, which shed water and smelled like a soggy cow, shrugged off his tunic, had nothing to hang it with. He draped it to dry on a low-hanging branch of a nearby tree, then sighed when a breeze showered droplets down from high leaves. Everyone wanted a fire, but the wood in the forest along the road was wet. Nothing would burn. Arryn resigned himself to the damp. He pitched his tent, peeled a broad strip of thick bark off a tree. The unexposed side was dry, and sat on it rather than the mud outside his tent, while he used his one dry shirt to wipe rain off anything metal so that it wouldn't rust. His sword, dagger, shield, armor buckles, the horse tack. It felt nothing like summer. Arryn was chilled, the skin along his back unpleasantly tight. A lock of wet hair flopped down along his cheek. He shuddered, brushed it away, and kept polishing with the shirt, rubbing at the bits and buckles on the bridle and girth. He warmed a little from the activity.
"Well, well, look at you!"
Roshar stood in front of him, hands on his hips, armor unbuckled but still on.
"So industrious. Cold too, I bet."
Arryn ignored him.
"While you're at it," Roshar said. "Want to dry my things, too?"
Arryn paused, looked up, and made a gesture he'd learned in the East. Roshar laughed. He squished his way toward his tent. Arryn heard him call for one of his underlings. Then Arryn stopped paying attention. After a while, though, a prickle crept up his neck. At first, Arryn thought it was the cold. But he wasn't finished with his task, and so didn't pull the mostly dry shirt over his head, which was what he longed to do. He kept at what he was doing. Slowly, he became aware of a surprised quiet stealing over the camp. The sodden thuds of a lone horse's hooves approaching. Then someone, a Dacron, said,
"Stay where you are!"
Arryn heard the crank of a crossbow. He looked up just as the rider stopped. There, high up on her stallion, hair plastered to her head, expression bleak, was Kestrel. 20. He went to her, yanking his clammy tunic off the tree as he passed, shrugging into it. Her hands clenched the reins, body stiff. She'd been riding for a long time. She had a stunned look that reminded him badly of the tundra. Everything about her was rigid and wrong. He took her by the waist and lifted her down. Vivid with confusion and worry, he said,
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't keep my promise to you."
"That doesn't matter."
"I gave you my word. A Valorian honors her word."
She swayed slightly. He flipped open Javelin's saddlebag. No food, no clothes, not a match, not a bit of tinder, not even a canteen, just a burned-out lamp.
"Kestrel, you're scaring me."
"I'm sorry."
He got her to his tent, ignoring the curious stares, and was grateful, without quite knowing why, that Roshar was nowhere to be seen. Arryn grabbed his dry shirt from where he'd let it fall to the ground and dug his clean trousers out of a saddlebag, his canteen, some hardtack, gone sticky with the damp.
"Here."
He pressed it all into her hands.
"Change. Eat. I'll be outside."
She nodded. He was shakily relieved to get a response that seemed, small as it was, normal. Then she disappeared into his tent, and he became anxious again. Moments passed. There was a rustle from inside the tent. It subsided. He asked if she was all right. No answer. Finally, he was too concerned not to come inside. She was sitting, staring into her lap, holding the unopened canteen. She'd changed into his shirt, then appeared to have reached the limit of what she could do. She still wore her wet trousers, the riding boots, her dagger. The hardtack lay to the side, untouched. He knelt and took her freezing hands.
"Please tell me what's wrong,"
She opened her mouth, but choked on the words. She looked brittle. He began to feel the way she looked. He tried a different question.
How did you know where we'd be?
I guessed. Aaron stared. I thought maybe Larilyn, but my father, I know what he's like. So I thought... She halted. He didn't like the way her voice collapsed when she mentioned the general. The Aerolith estate. Livestock, meadows, trees, water. It'd make sense. To him. I worried. Maybe you wouldn't think of Aerolith. Or you would and ignore it. But I hoped... He felt a flash of wild fear. To wander vaguely south, unsupplied, alone, practically unarmed, on a gamble, a guess. It shook him.
You don't even have a map.
He tried to say nothing else. He worried that she'd see the extremity of what he felt and recoil from it.
I've seen the right maps before. I remembered.
Her face contorted.
You don't have to say.
Let me. I want to. I went to the villa, my house, after I left your suite. I didn't mean to stay there so long. I'm sorry.
You've nothing to apologize for.
Yes, I was so sure. On the tundra, I blamed you. The blame rotten inside me. But when I went home, I remembered. The prison wasn't your fault. It was mine. It was his.
Aaron went cold. His suspicion took its final shape.
Your father?
Yes.
Your father betrayed you.
I wrote a letter to you when I was in the capital. So stupid, to put it all in writing. Everything I'd done, the information I passed to Tenzin, the way I worked against the Empire, what I felt. My father read it. He gave it to the Emperor.
She was weeping.
And I know that it hurt him, that I broke something, that he felt it break. Maybe I wasn't me anymore to him. Do you understand? Not his daughter, not anyone he knew, just a lying stranger. But how could he? Why couldn't he love me most, or enough? Why couldn't he love me enough to choose me over his rules?
Aaron pulled her onto his lap. He held her shaking form, tucked his face into the crook of her cold neck as she sobbed against him. He murmured that he loved her more than he could say. He promised that he would always choose her first. She was exhausted, and she fell asleep quickly. Aaron sat beside her for a few long moments after. Murder rose in his heart. The general was out of reach for now, but someone closer by would do. He left the tent and didn't have to go far. Rashara was waiting for him.
Here we have an unexpected guest, said the prince.
Aaron clamped a hand down on his shoulder and drove him into the trees. Rashar, oddly enough, made no sound until enough distance had been put between them and the army. When they wouldn't be overheard, he said cautiously.
Aaron, why are you manhandling me?
You knew. Specificity, please.
On the morning we left, you knew that her horse wasn't in the stables. That's why you saddled a horse and brought it to me, so that I wouldn't notice that she was gone. You are a liar.
That's not a lie.
Silence.
Aaron, you are crushing me. Fine, yes, all right. I might have gently deceived you in the name of your greater happiness. Is it really a lie? Or if it is, isn't it a very, very small one?
He showed with his fingertip and thumb just how small.
You don't know what makes me happy.
I know that you're not.
I know that you've no sense of reason where she's concerned. Maybe I did observe that Javelin wasn't in his stall that morning. Maybe I knew how things would unfold, how you'd notice and go tearing off after her wherever she was, and my sister would learn of it. What would my soldiers think if I waited for you, or if we marched south without you? It'd all fall apart. So yes, I lied. I'd do it again. My only other option was to watch you throw everything away for the sake of someone who doesn't even love you.
Aaron released him. He felt brutally gutted.
You wanted the truth, said the prince.
Aaron thought of Cheat, Tenzin, Kestrel. He wondered if some part of him was drawn to lies. What was it that made him so easy to deceive?
Oh, Aaron, don't look like that.
I apologize.
He stared at his friend, who was still his friend. It struck him that Rashar had gone quietly into the trees, because if he had protested, his army would have cut Arryn down.